It's wonderful. It's not surprising, but it is wonderful, isn't it, when God goes ahead and he does things in the first part of the service you're going to talk about in the second part. So it won't surprise you to know that I was going to start by speaking about family. What are some of your long-lasting family memories? Any contributions? Not in detail, but just generally. What would they centre around? Meals tend to be the focus of special family events, don't they? And, yeah, we can look back. You know, the other year I found some very long lost slides, which I sort of got up onto the computer and found all these 21st birthdays, my brother's and mine, and how similar they were. It was quite interesting. I remember how my dad and one of the boys used to walk down to the local church. It was about a quarter of a mile away, and carry back some trestle tables and put them in our... We only lived in a flat, so it was fairly small. And how all the old relatives would come and we'd all sit round, you know. And it was the same for each one. We didn't have to think about the menu. We knew what it was going to be, ham salad and crisps and bread and trifle and fruit salad. You know, it was pretty basic, but it was wonderful. We loved it. And Christmas is a bit like that. And of course, as we get more grey hairs, some of us, when our generation, my generation, gets together, we tend to just think back to some of these wonderful times. Do you remember Auntie Molly's teas, how the table was groaning, you know? And the same thing comes out time and again. And some of these memories are very precious because they're part of who we are as people. And we look back, whether we can look back just a few years or further. So we've been going backwards through the Exodus story. And last week, we arrived at the point of deliverance. And Chris led us through that. And to start today, I'd like to fast forward maybe 1,400 years. If you want to look, the main passages I'll be picking up things from, perhaps not so much quoting, are from Mark 12, Mark 14, and Exodus 12. The disciples were getting restless. They sort of had that feeling, you know, like you do when something's up, but you're not quite sure what it is that's happening. They were disturbed because Jesus had been talking a lot about dying, and they were comfortable with it. They didn't really appreciate what he was saying. They hadn't got the message. But there was something going on. You know that unsettled feeling that you get, that things are not as they should be. But then it was the Passover. Now, the Passover was the celebration of the year. It was the great family time when the families would travel down to Jerusalem, and if they could, or if they couldn't, they'd, I guess, have to stay where they were, but they would have this wonderful celebration. And that would have been a tremendous comfort to them. It was so traditional. They knew what to expect. They were on safe ground, so they thought. But how did it work out? Well, Jesus was aware that the end of his ministry was close. And so he asked two of his disciples to go and prepare the Passover meal so that he and the 12 could eat together. And he told them what to do, where to go, who to meet, and what to prepare. And for those two men that went off, it was nothing particularly unusual. There were time-honoured traditions laid down. And they understood what was expected of them. Jesus said to them, you've got to go. Actually, it was a secret location. The reason being that he knew that the Jews were out to plot, they were plotting to be out to kill him. And he was in control of the time, and it wasn't quite his time. There were things and events to go through first. And so it was slightly unusual. If you read in Mark 14, you'll see how Jesus told them to go to a certain place. They'd see a man carrying a water jar, which was slightly unusual. They were to follow him, go to the master of the house and say, where is the room that you have said the teacher may come and celebrate Passover? And it was a large room, and they wouldn't have to worry about what to get ready because it was all prescribed and laid down. And so instead of that underlying anxiety, there was this pleasant sense of anticipation, because I think we feel that, don't we? When we know what's coming, it just sort of settles us in a troubled period. The evening started well, and as is the tradition today amongst Jews, the youngest person in the household there would ask the question, why are we doing this? How did this celebration come about? You know, what does it all mean? And Jesus, the teacher, would have been the one to answer. And so this is where we go back to Exodus. Some of it we've heard already. So there have been 9 plagues. Each one had become increasingly powerful. Each one came against one of the gods of the Egyptians. But in spite of this, in spite of the warnings of Moses and Aaron going to see Pharaoh before each one, Pharaoh hardened his heart. He gave them nothing. About 430 years before, the Hebrews, the Israelites, had gone, because of Joseph being there with Jacob and all his family, into Egypt. And there they'd been welcome, guests, honoured. They were given the best part of the land to live in. But that had changed, and they'd become bonded slaves. And bitterness characterised their lives. And there was infanticide. There was starvation. There was deprivation. And these requests to go and worship their God failed time and again, 9 times. The plagues happened to the Egyptians, but the Hebrews themselves were spared. At times, maybe it seemed a little as though Pharaoh was going to waver, but he always went back on his word. This time was different. Moses and Aaron went into Pharaoh and they told him exactly what to expect. What they said was, Israel is God's firstborn son. But you have taken his life, you've reduced it to servitude and slavery, and so God now is going to take the life of your firstborn son. In every household, every first male born, their life will be taken, and even the male offspring of the cattle will be killed. Was Pharaoh moved? Sadly not. And Moses and Aaron, who must have been in huge frustration as well as huge anger, they walked out and left him. But this occasion was different for the Israelites too, of course, because they didn't watch from the sidelines. They had to be fully involved. With all the previous plagues, they probably were just spectators watching from a safe distance, thinking, that's happening to Egypt. They're getting their comeuppance. But this time, they needed to exercise faith. Straightforward, very direct. But to be safe, they had to follow. And what they had to do, and God told Moses very carefully, was to choose a male lamb, 1 year old. They had to keep it for 4 days, watching it carefully to make sure that it was absolutely perfect in every way. They had to choose one that was the right size for their family, because the whole aim was that the whole lamb would be eaten. And if it was too big, then they could join with other families, but join together in one place and have a lamb that was the right size, and so that they could eat it all. And in the meantime, while they were getting ready, they had to clean their houses. They had to get rid of every trace of yeast. And we know that through the Bible, yeast speaks of sin and the things that creep in. And they had to use this preparation time to be sure that there wasn't anything, any trace of sin, any trace of yeast in their lives. God uses practical things to demonstrate what he wants to do within us. And that's what the Passover is about, as we're unfolding it and see. You know, God's heart is for us to clean out. But for them, it needed to be a practical something. They had to get rid of the yeast. They had to clean their houses, because God so often speaks to us through pictures, doesn't he? And through actions. And sometimes our heart response follows on afterwards. They had to prepare bitter herbs because their time in Egypt had been bitter. It was unbearably harsh, you know, as is the life of many in slavery today. And they had to get ready to leave in a hurry and put on their travel clothes. So it was twilight on the fourth day. They would slaughter the lamb, they'd catch the blood in a bowl, they'd dip some hyssop in it, and they'd plaster the outside, paint the outside frame of the door lintels with the blood. Because this time was different. God wasn't going to send a plague, God was going to come himself. There wasn't any more time for warning, and you'll remember from the times that we've looked through the book of Exodus how God is a holy God and how he is separate and how he cannot be received lightly. And so he is coming with a sword in his hand this time. And so who could be saved from him? So the instructions were roast the lamb whole. Make sure you don't break any of its bones. It's all significant. Make sure you eat all of it, together with the bread made without yeast and with the bitter herbs. In your homes, you'll be safe. And this time, the Egyptians are going to beg you to leave. And that is, of course, just what happened. They chose the lamb. They followed the instructions. They obeyed them to the letter. In faith, they went in through the bloodstained doors. Everyone in the household would be counted in, and they were safe. The life is in the blood, Moses said to them later on in his instructions. And it's the blood that makes atonement, the blood that brings us to God, the blood that opens the way for us to be with him. There's no intrinsic value in blood. It wasn't magic in any way. But it is very, very highly significant because God says, when I see the blood, I will pass over. It was the blood of the lamb that was over them, over the door. It was that sacrifice that was enough. And the faith they had to exercise does seem very small, doesn't it, in comparison? It was. The deliverance was all God's doing. But faith is actually very small when we think about our faith in comparison with God's amazing faith. Faith is seeing and hearing what God is doing and cooperating with him, but God brings the results. But as we trust God to do that, he graciously includes us. As Paul said, God who works in you to will and to act according to his good purpose. From Philippians there. And prayer is like that. We've been hearing about answers to prayer, haven't we? Amazing that God answers our prayers. It is a mystery, but we know that it's God that does the work. God brings things about, and yet he asks us to reach out in faith to him and to ask him. He asks us to reach out and to bless one another. He gives us gifts so that we can bless one another. But it's God who is at work in us to do the blessing. We might have to be the hands here. We might have to speak the words now. But it's God whose power is there. And so with the Hebrews, the Jews, the angel of death passed over their homes. The blood spoke of the sacrifice that was made on their behalf. They didn't have to die. The lamb was a substitute. Moses said to Pharaoh, Israel is God's firstborn son. And Israel now was to be free at last. This was their redemption. And could we possibly imagine from all that they'd been through that they would say, no thanks? We'll just stick it out. We actually would rather stay in this place or that place. I think it's very, very unlikely that anybody would have been that foolish. Sadly, as Chris said last week, once they reached the wilderness, they sort of had this great blank in their minds. They forgot. They forgot what they'd left, and they were tempted to want the old way, and they had this amazing view. Perhaps life wasn't as bad as we thought. Have you ever thought that? You've been through a really tough time, and after a space, you look back and you think, oh, maybe it wasn't really that bad. Memory does play tricks on us, doesn't it? They thought, oh, do you remember we had fish and cucumbers and melons and grapes and wonderful food, yeah, onions and garlic, you know. Their memory played huge tricks. They forgot the servitude. Their bodies left Egypt, but their hearts and their minds got a bit stuck. But actually, Passover was the gate through which they had to pass. And this was going to be the night that Pharaoh was defeated, even though his end finally came in the Red Sea. So, let's forward the clock again, back another 1,400 years. The evening didn't quite go, did it, as the disciples were expecting. They were hoping for tradition, for safety, for security, that they could take a deep breath, settle down, and really relax and enjoy the evening. But actually, they were going to change forever. Jesus, during the meal, would take the cup. It was passed around several times. And he said, "This is my blood that is going to be shed for you, for your forgiveness," as it says in Hebrews. "This is the new covenant. You're going to be cleansed by my blood. That's the way your sins are forgiven." Jesus said, "Actually, I'm the Lamb." We've been singing about the Lamb. "I'm the one that's going to die. But I want you to be part of me. I want you to be part of this. I want you to join with me in it." And passing around the bread, he said, "You know, this represents my body, which is going to be broken." And for them, it was that very, very night, wasn't it? Broken for you in death. But this bread is to join you with me and with each other as you share it. And just as Jesus had said before, it was his blood, like the blood over the door, that was going to be the way in for them so that they could come in. And Jesus says, "I am the gate. By me you can come in and out and find safe pasture." He is the door. He is the one through whom we can be saved. But why? Why did Jesus himself have to take the place of the lamb? Well, the death of the sacrificial lambs every year had no power to remove sin and death. They pointed forwards, but actually death, the greatest slave master of all, sin that holds us in its grip, Jesus could do that. Sacrificial lambs can never do that, but Jesus could, because he is the perfect lamb. He never sinned, and his death would take the place of theirs. In the Old Testament, the lives of the firstborn were brought back with the offering of a sacrificial lamb. And parents would bring their newborn into a place of worship, and they would make an offering. If they were wealthy enough, they would offer a lamb to redeem the life of their firstborn. If they weren't, they might, as Jesus' parents, brought a couple of doves, didn't they? But it had no power. That offering had no power to change hearts and lives. The Israelites, as we heard last week, were delivered, but so soon their gratitude turned on its head and turned to persistent grumbling and moaning and rebellion. And the gifts and the sacrifices that had been offered and were continually offered really didn't have the power to change and clean their conscience. I guess we can think of ourselves, you know, do we need to be freed from something? Are we freed or are we slaves? We've been singing about, I'm no longer a slave to fear, I'm a child of God. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that amazing? You know, sin is sort of idolatry, isn't it? It's doing things my way, trying to work out our own salvation, thinking, I don't need to do it God's way. I can do it this way. But we can so easily end up by idolising our own efforts. Whereas God wants us to humble ourselves and to submit to the path of obedience that leads to life and liberty, and to follow his way even when it hurts, and to give ourselves to him. It can be very humbling to receive a great gift from someone when you have no means of returning it in kind. But that's what God is doing for us. And we too are told to remember, whenever we eat together, remember Jesus. Remember, we were slaves of a harder taskmaster than Egypt. Remember, Jesus gave his life freely in place of ours. He died so we could live. He is the Lamb. We are the ones who receive his life. And the psalmist said, I'll remember the deeds of the Lord. Yes, I'll remember your miracles of long ago. And we want to remember Jesus. Were the disciples like the people of Israel? Did they change? Well, yes, because whereas the animal's sacrifice was just a reminder, a sort of a prompt, a pointer looking forward to Jesus, of course, to what God was going to do, only a few who saw that, saw beyond the actual animal sacrifice, with the eyes of faith, to look to the God who saves. There were men and women like that throughout the Old Testament, but there were many who didn't see beyond the actual sacrifice itself. But when Jesus died, his death took the full power, the full force of the power of sin, and the consequence that it has in death. And Jesus defeated it. Isn't that great? Isn't that wonderful? That Jesus actually, once and for all, rid Satan of his great power. He robbed him. And we can be set free too from the vice-like grip of sin. Not at all relying on our own strength and ability, but in faith, going through that door that Jesus has opened, acknowledging that he has given his life for us, seeing that because he defeated death itself, he rose again. And he invites us, of our own free will, to join with him, to die to our old way of life, ruled by sin, and to receive the new life that he offers, and to be willing to be changed. And when we are, which we know about, don't we, to remember and to be thankful again and again. There's no further sacrifice that needs to be made. Jesus made a new covenant. He set it down in his blood. It's never to be repeated. And so, when we go off to our celebrations, when we have lunch today, let's remember, let's be thankful, let's celebrate God's great goodness. He's given us redemption, he's given us freedom, and we by faith and obedience can be part of what Jesus has done for us. So he is our Passover lamb. Paul said, get rid of the old yeast, don't worry about it. It's no great thing, you know. Just get rid of whatever is holding you back so that you can be a new, unleavened batch, as you really are. Isn't that great? Isn't that great? For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. We know what God has done in us. We know we've enjoyed it. We've rejoiced in it. But let's be thankful. Sometimes we don't recognise God's at work in our lives. many unexpected situations sort of work out and resolve. But when we see, let's pause, let's give thanks, for he has redeemed us and we belong to him. Hallelujah.